chance. Okay, as I said in the posting we put out in advance, we're starting this term, continuing the theme of the response of the Achronim this year, this term, with a focus on the chief rabbis of Medinat Yisrael, and starting with Rav Kook, I guess, so not just Medinat Yisrael, but Eretz Yisrael. It's going to be, like it was, I guess, last term, a certain sort of journey in terms of seeing how the issues, certain issues perhaps were timeless or continuous over the course of the 100 years or so that there was a chief rabbinate in Israel, and some of them were, matters of the hour. And we'll see perhaps a certain shift in the role of chief rabbi as well. And this is perhaps one of the points that I found most interesting in looking at the Tshuvot of Rav Kook, is that, perhaps I have an Anglo-Jewish sense of what a chief rabbi is, in terms of his role, in terms of answering questions from the community and from beyond the community. Rav Kook, his Shelos and Tshuvot, you could go through all four volumes, and I'll mention what he wrote in just a moment, without having an inkling that he was actually the chief rabbi of Israel at a fairly important time in its development, in its historical development. I mean, Rav Kook is known, I'd say least well known as a halachist. In terms of when we think about Rav Kook, we think about Rav Kook and Zionism, perhaps Rav Kook and the Het HaMechira, Rav Kook as a mystic, the author of Orot and such things, Rav Kook as a lover of all of Am Yisrael. We tend not to think of him particularly as being a Baal Halacha, but very clearly he was. He wrote four volumes of Shelos and Tshuvot, Orach Mishpat on Orach Chaim, Dat Kohen on Yoredeya, Ezrat Kohen on Even HaEzer, and Mishpat Kohen on Choshen Mishpat. He was a Kohen. Don't know why. That's first one. Yeah, why he didn't call it Orach Kohen? Don't know. That's nothing in the introduction about that, I'm afraid. And covers the full range of Shelos and Tshuvot, which are opposed to major rabbinic figures, but nothing particularly to mark him out as being chief rabbi of Israel. He was receiving Shelos and, from all over the world, which reflects his status. Again, we tend to think of him as, a religious Zionist leader, but he was clearly, regarded as a halachic authority across the world, even from places which had other halachic authorities there. Lots of stuff to do with, mikvaot and divorce and agunas and gittin and, the standard high-level rabbinic issues. Not a lot. Last time we were looking at the various different achronim, and they all seem to have sort of a fair amount in there of timeless questions in their Shelos and Tshuvot. What do you do if you miss out Yale V'Yavo and that sort of thing? Questions which have been debated for 1,000 years. Not a lot of that. So I would say he was sort of responding to Dvarim Ha'omdim Al HaPerek, issues which were relevant, particularly relevant at that point in time. But only in the sense that, building, I suppose, building a lot of mikvaot, there happened to be issues to do with agunot, coming from, around the world, issues to do with gittin and kiddushin and such things, but nothing reflecting particularly an influx of Jewry into Eretz Yisrael or anything reflecting a particular burden as chief rabbi of a country. In terms of, I suppose, Rav Kook was the I think known as the Rosh HaRabbanim, so he was the head of the rabbinate. We tend to think of the chief rabbi being responsible for matters of policy issues and matters of halachic policy. Now, if the chief rabbi is involved in halachic decisions, it's matters of halachic policy. He's not involved in questions as to how the mikveh, how the new Golders Green mikveh should be built, and whether it should have this type of bore or that type of bore in it. Chief rabbi policy, halachic policy, perhaps to do with geirut, to do with limud or whatever it might be. But Rav Kook, no issues of halachic policy particularly. He was clearly regarded as an expert in all areas of halacha. That he knew how to build a mikveh, he knew how to set up an eruv, he knew how to he knew how to be masader a get, and such things. He had Beit Din experience. I mean, prior to being the Rav of Rav of Eretz Yisrael, the chief rabbi of Israel, he'd been the Rav of Yafo, he'd been Rav in London for a while, but when he was Rav in London, that was in the Machzikei Hadat. I don't think that was a Beit Din position, that he was the Rav of a shul, a community. That's when he was stranded at the outbreak of World War I. That's travelling back from Switzerland and couldn't get back to Eretz Yisrael for 3 or 4 years, so he ended up in the East End of London, and in back in Europe. He'd also been a Rav, of a Kehillah, and perhaps an Af Beit Din. So it's particularly interesting from that perspective. So if we were hoping to get lots of insights into Rav Kook and his Zionism, and how that, or his love of Am Yisrael, how that impacted on his tshuvot, there's actually not a lot of that there. It's fairly standard rabbinic themes. The only issue that I could see sort of coming out that really reflected the fact that Eretz Yisrael was going through a period of particularly important development for Am Yisrael was he's got a fair number of tshuvot on milking cows. That's And I guess milking cows was important if you lived in Russia, where he started off. If a person had a cow, they had one cow in the back in the backyard, and if they were dairy farmer, they had three cows. So it wasn't such an issue. I guess in Eretz Yisrael, where the farmers had herds of cows, and they were providing milk for big parts of the population, or the whole towns, or yeshivim, or whatever it was, then you had serious issues of milking the cows on Shabbat. That's the only issue that I really saw coming up, time and again. That's which perhaps gave you an inkling into his role in Eretz Yisrael. There's also, of course, the question of Shmita, and that comes up. But for Shmita, essentially, he wrote a separate treatise by itself, Shabbat Haaretz. And set down very important klalim for Shmita observance and for the Het HaMechira, etc., etc., which still followed today. And we had a shiur on the Het HaMechira a few months ago, just before Yom Kippur. So we've kind of touched on that. In any event, I managed to identify half a dozen tshuvot, which I felt represented some of the some aspects of Rav Kook as a person and as Chief Rabbi of Eretz Yisrael as well. I did say that we would find out what he had to say about Rav Hertz, Chief Rabbi Hertz, trying to change a minhag in the United Synagogue. So there's a slightly cryptic tshuva which he wrote in 1922 to somebody in London, where the suggestion was that in Musaf there didn't need to be a full Chazarat Hashatz, and just the Shliach Tzibur could say Musaf along out loud, and the Tzibur would say it along alongside quietly. It's kind of interesting, that, and so he opposes that. He says he brings from the Rambam that Musaf has to have a full Chazarat Hashatz, just like all the other tefillot have to, and he says, I'm not in London, so I don't really know what Harav HaDoctor had in mind. That's who was the Rav HaDoctor. So he doesn't mention Hertz by name, but Chief Rabbi Dr. Hertz was the chief rabbi at the time. It's interesting because already that was brought in, the notion of doing a Sfardi-style Heicha Kedusha Musaf was introduced already by the Adlers in 1892, and that was practiced till very recently in Hampstead Synagogue, for example, and prior to that in a number of the other very anglicised congregations. In Hampstead Synagogue till about 10 years ago, they were a type of community that wanted to allow people to daven Musaf in accordance with their own consciences, i.e. whether you pray for the restoration of the Korbanot or not, as in good Anglo-Jewish tradition. That's it would be quite offensive really to have a full repetition of Yom Yidduch for that sort of thing. That's so that, but those passages were just recited silently. So I'm not quite sure where it fits in historically, this reference to Chief Rabbi Hertz wanting to change the practice, because as far as my research goes, that's that was going on already. Anyhow, let's start with a question that was addressed to him from Cleveland. So this was coming from the United States. It's the status of civil marriage. That's something that we saw a number of times in the last term, Rav Moshe Feinstein and others addressing the question, what is the status of civil marriage? I want to, it's a short teshuva. He actually has, I think, two teshuvot on this subject. One is long, one is short. So I've brought the short teshuva. But Bedavar kiddushin de'erkaot. So as far as civil marriage is concerned, I've been very difficult, very busy, and I haven't really been able to deal with the topic properly. But to sum things up briefly, we can say as follows: that not all cases are the same. So you've got to judge each case on its merits. Ki eile shirat mitoch rashlanut or hedyotot nistapku b'nisuim halalu. They've got some people who are getting married civilly mitoch rashlanut, that laziness, or hedyotot. They don't really understand what the issues are, and they're getting married civilly. Yesh chashash shel kiddushin. Then maybe this is kiddushin. She'em ha'pirsum she'em chayim chaye ishut, because they're getting married. They're having a ceremony, they're living together as Mr. and Mrs. That would indicate that they're intending to live together as a married couple. So that's one type of grouping. Aval eile shemitoch ha'efkerut ube'ita b'dat Yisrael chayim, that there are some people who are trying to reject the Jewish tradition. Kvar lehem lo shach lomar klal hachazaka shel ein adam oseh beilato beilat zanut. We can't apply the principle of ein adam oseh beilato beilat zanut. And this is one of the principles that Rav Moshe Feinstein was addressing. This tshuva would have been written in 1931. Rav Moshe was addressing the subject some 20, 30 years later. And we saw others who addressed it prior to Rav Moshe. But one of the key issues is the principle, halachic Talmudic principle of ein adam oseh be'ilato be'ilat zanut, that a person, people aren't promiscuous. So if a couple set up home together, we assume that they're not intending to live in a promiscuous manner, but they're intending to live as husband and wife. So then you've got the whole question that, well, if it's clear that they're not intending to live as husband and wife, they are being promiscuous, then maybe it's not kiddushin. So this is, what the whole discussion hinges on. And what Rav Kook is saying is there's two different types of people. There's some people who think that this is a perfectly acceptable way to get married. They wouldn't dream of living in sin, but we want to have a marriage. That's our parents want us to get married, whatever it is. That's want to have the joint bank account, so they get married and they think that civil marriage is marriage. Then he says that might well be Kiddushin. But if it's people who know full well that marriage is Kedat Moshev Yisrael, and they choose to be Chofshiim, that's and free-minded in this matter, so then we can say that they're not worried about living in in a modest fashion and conduct Moshev Yisrael. And that's Bilat's not. They've rejected marriage. So really, I think what he's asking is, have these people actively rejected Jewish marriage or not? If they've actively rejected Jewish marriage, we can say, Adam Oseh Bilat or Bilat's not. This is a form of promiscuity. If not, then we can then we could say that it is a form of marriage, which would necessitate a get afterwards. So a little bit different to what Rav Moshe's logic was.
What do you need basic minimum for a marriage? Is it literally witnesses and a ring?
No, you might not need it. No, you might not need even that. In terms of if you've got witnesses to the fact that the couple are living together as husband and wife. Certainly this was the whole consideration of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now he said, you've got a couple, they're living in the middle of Golders Green. Right? So they're coming to Al Eitz Zion Shul on the Shabbat together. She wearing a fancy hat and they're inviting friends back to their house for Shabbat lunch. Right? So they might have got married in a registry office, but that is, everybody knows they're living as husband and wife. That is, Rav Moshe seemed to think that might need a get. That's exactly how we're passing this is a different question. But Rav Moshe indicated that could well need a get. Right? Rav Kook is saying slightly differently. He's saying, what was their motivation for civil marriage? If their motivation for civil marriage, but clearly you don't need Edim. That's an Edim and a ring. If their motivation for civil marriage was because that to get married in a shul, they don't feel so frum, and they don't really know a rabbi very well, and shul weddings are always expensive, so they'll get married in registry office. So, you know, and anyhow, her cousins are communists, so they wouldn't come to the shul. So then, they're not rejecting Jewish tradition. They're just opting for something else, sort of not really realizing how important Jewish tradition is. So there, that might be counted as kiddushin. Whereas if it's a couple who are flag-waving Bundists, who are going to sing Palmach songs, at the wedding reception with a toast to Lenin and whatever it is. I don't know if all those things go together, Bundist, Lenin and Palmach. But you get the idea. So then we can't say ein adam b'oseh b'ilat or b'ilat. That could be just what we would halachically call promiscuity. Avam b'nei shadavat tzarich b'china rabba b'hayishim v'amichshol hu karov. Seeing as you really have to examine each case in its own merits, understand the motivation of the couple, and it's fraught with halachic minefields. Alkein lo eretzelim so bazeh devarim l'rabim. So I really don't want to make this matter public, but those are my thoughts, he's saying. So I chose this tshuva because I think it's representative or illustrative of the way that Rav Kook is looking at different types of people and where they're coming from, what their motivation might be. Now, a well-trodden halachic area is the question in Hilchot Tzedakah of who's entitled to receive Ma'ot Tzedakah. And here Rav Kook is addressing a question with regard to if you have two people, two aniyim come before you, and you haven't got funds to give each of them what they need in this regard. So putting aside the question whether it's better to give each of them half or not, but you've got one meal to give, and there are two aniyim there. The question of who takes priority, and the halachic priority goes to a person who is religiously observant, whereas if you've got a person who is an avarian b'mezid, a person who is deliberately a transgressor. So we're not talking about a person who, forgets sometimes daven mincha, but a person who, deliberately, gets in his car and drives on Shabbat, to go and buy treif sausages in Tesco's, if it's still in business. Right, that's an Avaryamba amazing. He comes lower down in the order of priority for recipients. Now, if we look about five lines down in the paragraph, he says, this applies if we know that the person really is overbemazed. That means he's deliberately transgressing. It doesn't mean that he's just sort of, he talked during Chazar Tashatz because somebody asked him a question. But it's a person who makes a point of talking during Chazar Tashatz. That's, we know that he's deliberately transgressing. Aval bistam, but if we don't really know what the person's motivation is, danin or tola shogeg, then we'll regard him as being an inadvertent transgressor. And you don't have to give him a fahair, and you've got a chiyuv to provide him with food to eat. Omnam k'sher ba'u shnei aniyim, but if two aniyim come before you, v'im yado litein rak le'achad, you can only give to one of them. As bistam mishin iresh hu yoter kasher or yoter torani hu kodem. Whichever one seems to be frumer, however one's going to define that, that's they take precedent. But then we've got a very important line that he writes at the end. Uvichlal yesh bisman hazeh tzorech lahamshich rachamim al kol Yisrael. Nowadays, at this junction, this was written in 1933. Okay, tzorech lahamshich rachamim al kol Yisrael. We need to be merciful to all Jews. Mipnei atzarot gam ha'avar yanim shenirin kemezidim, because of the tzarot, because of the sufferings of the Jewish people throughout the course of history, gam ha'avar yanim shenirin kemezidim, even people who seem to be totally rejecting deliberately Jewish practice, yesh lomar shehin nechshavin kashogegin, we ought to regard them as being shogeg as well. So this is I think, a classic example of Rav Kook's Ahavat Yisrael, the fact that he could see the glimmer in every Jew's soul. And yeah, this person, he might seem a committed apikoros, but don't take it at face value. And nowadays the challenges of living in a secular galut are so great. That, or even if it's not in Galut, even if it's already back in Eretz Yisrael, but the challenges are so great towards religious faith, a person who's not from, we can't regard him as being an Avaryan and somebody who's disqualified themselves from being the recipient of our charity. So I think that's a very interesting tshuva that he has there.
Does that undo the previous thing about if you've got two people, how does that relate?
I think what he's saying is that in general, we want to give the benefit of that. If you've got no, because he's really referring to his first point. His first point was that if a person I glossed over it, but he said if a person is an Avaryan Bemezid, this is at the end of the third line down, Ein Chiyuv Lahakyoto. You don't have an obligation of tzedakah.
But then he says anyway, I will stand on
That's no. That means if you don't really know. So I'm saying if you know it, you've got various levels. You've got a person who's a committed that's committed apikoros, right? Then you've got a person who just doesn't seem so frum. I haven't had a theological discussion with him about why he drives on Shabbat. Is it because he just he doesn't give it much thought, or is he doing it because he knows it annoys the rabbi? Right? That's anti-Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's in that order. That's because he doesn't really believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's, yeah, so, if I haven't had the discussion with him, we'll regard him as being shogeg. As if I've had the discussion with him, he's amazing. But Rav Kook is saying, we don't really want to say that Jews are amazing. Be nice to Jews. That's, you haven't got a chiyuv to give him tzedakah. You know what? These days, we've just got to love every Jew. Give him tzedakah. Maybe he's an Avaryan b'shogeg. Having said that, Ralph Cook certainly wasn't a walkover, and wouldn't let people take liberties. The next tshuva deals with a. This was coming from somewhere outside of Eretz Yisrael, Feret, or wherever that is. It says in brackets where it is. That's Be'inyan Echad She'ishto Mechalelet Shabbat Pfar Hesher. Got a person, he's a frum Jew, his wife doesn't keep Shabbat at all. V'yota Osekeh B'chanuta P'tucha. She runs her business on Shabbat. Im Ra'u Liyot Manhig B'Veit HaKneset. Can this person be a manhig, a spiritual leader in the shul? I was once contacted by a certain provincial community. They wanted me to help them find a Baal Musaf for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And they had a Baal Shachrit. The Baal Shachrit was the warden. He could daven Shachrit quite nicely. They needed a Baal Musaf. The warden was married out. It wasn't just his wife wasn't from. He was married out to a non-Jewish lady. But she used to come to shul every Shabbat. She used to prepare the Kiddush. And he used to go to church on Sundays and sing in the church choir. So this isn't quite as bad as that. And he wasn't the warden, he was the manhig. So I'm not sure exactly what the manhig is, but the manhig seems to be some sort of spiritual leader. He says, I've addressed this in a previous tshuva. Yeah, you can't allow such things. You know, you can't. He might be frum if his wife isn't frum, and he can't. He's been unable to prevent her from being Mechalel Shabbat. So everybody's going to associate that sort of Chilul Shabbat with him as well. It's going to be a big Chilul Hashem that such a person should be a spiritual leader. So, you know, he wasn't cutting corners there at all. There's another tshuva where he discusses the case of a shochet. Now, shochtim are interesting positions. In a classic sense, it isn't really true any longer, but in a classical sense, the position of shochet was a position of some authority in the community. It wasn't just that you happened to be the person who worked in the abattoir, but it was a position of leadership and religious influence in the community. So he's got a discussion about a shochet whose children aren't from. Is he allowed to continue being a shochet? We've got no questions about his shechita, just is it appropriate that he, and his conclusion is not. His conclusion was that if it's a sort of a low level, you know, shochet, just does a few chickens, you know, once a month or something like that, that's fine. But to be have the position of communal shochet, then that's inappropriate. That's apparently about, I don't know, about 40 years ago, as the shochtim had a pay, threatening to go on strike over pay. So they went to the chief rabbi to try and resolve the issue. So he wasn't able to grant them a pay rise, but he allowed them to use the title reverend. That really paid the mortgage. That's in terms of, you know, it was a position of, you know, of substance in the kehillah. And Rav Cook felt very, very strong, you know, if you've got that position of substance, whether it's a shochet or a manhig, then, you know, your family has to, you know, reflect in some way, or at least mustn't be doing things which are totally at odds with the position that you hold. Nevertheless, he says in the middle paragraph, Omlam kasher katvu lichvodo, shesham yesh beit hakneset reform me. I can see the problem in this case is there's a reform shul there. There's nobody else who wants to be the rabbi here. You know, you're talking about, you know, the rabbi Dundee, right? You know, so in Dundee, they've got, you know, one person there who's, you know, willing to be the minister in Dundee. There are not a lot of people who applied for that position last time it came vacant, you know, minister of Dundee. Yeah? And if the Orthodox don't aren't in charge of the community in Dundee, the reform will get in there very quickly. So that's essentially the question that he's... That's okay. I mean, nowadays you've got Chabad will go there. So it'll be different. But so he says, in that case, it might well be different. That's if the alternative is that the Kehillah is going to go reform, so then we can live with it. That. Sorry. Okay. Right. That's let me get a port. Maybe Perth. Yes, that's right. Perth. Okay. Very good. That's thank you. That's Perth, West Australian. Thank you. That's your Yiddish reading is very good. Okay. Right. So. It'd be interesting to know. This is an undated teshuvah, but it would be interesting to know sort of how much, how many Jews there were in Perth in, probably 1920, 1930, something like that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I had a friend in Yeshiva who was from Perth. That's we always used to tease him that we presumed his ancestors were convicts, but maybe they got a £10 ticket instead. That's okay. So that's the case that's dealing with, and we see that he's making this distinction between he's looking at the wider picture. The wider picture as well. Though he goes on to stress the importance of fighting against Chilul Shabbat and how this is really a very b'diavad situation to have where the rabbi's wife is at the hairdresser's on Shabbos morning. Let's turn the page. No, well, he says he can't. He doesn't really know. He says the third paragraph. He doesn't know exactly what the situation is. So he's giving us klalim rather than a psak din. I think his conclusion was that if there's somebody else to do the job, then you should take somebody else should be doing the job. But if there isn't, and the alternative is that the community is going to go reform, so then let this person carry on as the manhig. Now, the next two tshuvot shed a certain amount of light on certain aspects in Rav Kook's perception of how Eretz Yisrael and Medinat Yisrael should develop. Obviously, Medinat Yisrael still at the time was a dream. As I said, there are a number of tshuvot to do with the question of milking cows on Shabbat. So milking cows is, according to most poskim, is an issur d'oraita. That's part of the issur of dash, which is winnowing. That's how is this winnowing? Well, threshing. It's a form of threshing. You're not threshing your cow, but threshing is where you're extracting the food from what is protecting it. Here you're extracting the milk from the from the cow, and he's got a number of tshuvot on this subject. Points out, for all the Rishonim and Acharonim have always held that it's an issur d'oraita. You can't just come along and change things overnight. Of course, the realities were shifting somewhat in terms of if you lived in Poland and had one cow, right, and a Shabbos goy, so the Shabbos goy would come and milk the cow. That's where you've got a herd of cows and you're in a Jewish yeshuv somewhere where there isn't a Shabbos goy, you've got much more of a problem. There are all sorts of eitzahs that were given that you should squeeze the milk onto food, and therefore it's just like you're allowed to squeeze lemon over your fish on Shabbat, so it might fall into that, or you can squeeze with your left hand. So it's a shinui, and he discusses all those. And he's totally dismissive of them. He says they're big rabbonim who made these suggestions, and they've all got Yirat Shamayim, and everybody's just interest at heart, but they've just got this wrong. That kibalti et michtavov in nila hashivoy. This is addressed to the the mayor of Pardes Chana, lichvod ha'adon, Mar Moshe whatever it is. So it's not to a rabbi, but it's somebody important in Paradis Chana. In Ilashivo, I have to tell you, ki ha-chaliva b'shabbat kodesh al-yidei Yisrael, who iso gamo v'chilul shabbat nora. Milking a cow, a Jew milking cows on Shabbat, totally also, it's a big chilul Shabbat. The chas shalom laharot bazet tzadkula. Got no grounds for leniencies. That's ein shum derech kim laklov shabbat al-yidei nochri. The only way you can deal with it is a goy should milk the cows on Shabbat. So as an aside, you know, there's Rav Cook, you know, in the less Zionist circles, you know, he's often dismissed as, you know, oh, you know, a lenient lover of Israel who, you know, oh, for Yeshiva Israel can allow anything. You know, this was a matter of massive economic concern in Eretz Israel. Rav Cook was putting his foot down quite conclusively against it. You have to do it with the goy, as our ancestors have always done. Now this is the what I found was the fascinating point. It's impossible to have a Jewish settlement without having some non-Jews there. Because you need the Shabbos goy. That's there are certain things which you can only do with a goy. And the dinim in the Torah are more important than any other ideas that people have dreamt up. And Torah observance is the basis of our existence al Admat HaKodesh, on the holy soil of Eretz Israel. So there's so much in these few lines, I think, about Rav Cook's perception of Eretz Israel. But he is known as this lover of Am Yisrael, undoubtedly so, but he's making it very clear that, you know, Rav Cook had this reputation, you know, he would go round to the non-observant kibbutzim, etc., etc., etc. You know, but he's making very clear, you know, our future in Eretz Israel is dependent on Torah observance. That's number one. Number two, he's well aware of the economic challenges, but he's not willing to budge, and many other Rabbonim have been makel, but he's not willing to budge on this issue. Thirdly, and this is an issue that, you know, is still discussed, particularly in religious Zionist circles, you know, the whole question of, you know, the role of the Gentile in Israeli society, as in, you know, religious Israeli society. And I've heard discussions, you know, Israeli doctors, you know, so in some of the hospitals, you know, they have certainly the halachic hospitals, you know, they have arrangement, you know, Arabs, Arab drivers collecting, you know, the Jewish doctors and bringing them to the hospital, you know, on Shabbat. But I've heard, you know, Jewish doctors say, you know, it doesn't make sense that we should have to, you know, that we should have to rely on Goyim in Eretz Israel. That's, you know, a Jewish state should, a halachic Jewish state should be able to function without recourse to the Shabbos Goy. The notion of Shabbos Goy is a remnant of the diaspora and is not what we're aspiring Eretz Israel to be. Rav Cook is saying that, yes, you couldn't run Eretz Israel as a Jewish state. You know, you need a few Shabbos goyim. It's like the old, you know, the old, you know, joke of, you know, a Jew from a little shtetl somewhere that meets a Jew from Vilna. They're discussing how many people live in their shtetl, and the Jew from the shtetl says, "Well, we've got, you know, we've got about 500 Jews." And yeah, there's the Jewish shtetl, there's 10 goyim. That's the Jew from Vilna. How many have you got Jews in Vilna? Vilna, we've got 500,000 Jews. 500,000 Jews, wow. How many goyim? That's 4 million goyim. Yes. What does 500,000 Jews need 4 million Shabbos goyim for? That's, you know, how you regard the role of the Jew in the society. Rav Cook is saying that, you know, to be able to live a Torah society, to develop a Torah society, you need goyim to be part of that, almost to serve us. I mean, we've got anyhow the notion, you know, almost there being, you know, ger toshav in Eretz Israel, you know, Gentiles accepted upon himself the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. He hasn't become Jewish, but, you know, they're allowed to live here in Eretz Israel. Presumably, they would be the, in an ideal world, they would be the Shabbos Goy. That's, according to some contemporary poskim, Muslims have the din of ger toshav. But Rav Kook isn't uncomfortable with the notion of there being Gentiles in Eretz Israel who will enable us to keep Shabbat properly.
The only thing is, in the words of Rav Kook, it's not necessarily talking about the ideal world, and that's relevant that in the Yeshiva as a whole, the portion of Jews to non-Jews at this time,
no, I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether he talks about Yishuv Yehudi. I don't know if he's talking about the Yishuv with a capital Y, right, as a whole. You know, he's talking about, you know, Pardes Chana, you know.
But all I'm saying, maybe he didn't imagine then that there would be 7 million Jews in it. Or he wasn't talking about a time in which there were.
And therefore,
now perhaps
he would be more makel.
Less feasible to have non-Jews and more desirable in other respects to have Jews.
You can never project, you know, what he would have thought of. But I the way I'm reading it, I think he's saying that this is the way Jewish society works. You know, yeah, you need some non-Jews to. You know, because there are certain things that we can only do Aliday Goy on Shabbat. We're not going to say, well, don't do it at all. And we're not going to say, well, let a Jew do it. You know, Shabbat observance involves having a Shabbos Goy as well. And he seems comfortable with that. Yeah.
Did he have anything to say on the animal?
Yeah. No, that's what, get a Goy to do it.
And if there wasn't a Goy around...
You know, he's saying, get a Goy to do it. He's saying, get a Goy to do it.
And he just leaves it at that point.
Yeah, that's what all the, you know, all the poskim, that's why you're allowed to do it with a Goy. You're not, why else should you be allowed to milk the cow even with a Goy? I can't get a Goy to do a Stam Malacha for me. Yeah. I can get the Goy to milk the cow because it's Tzar Balei Chaim. So because it's Tzar Balei Chaim, I can get the Goy to do it. That's the whole heter of letting the Goy do it. That's, okay. A similar issue comes up in the question of medical research on Jewish cadavers. How do you pronounce it properly? Cadavers? Cadavers? Cadavers. Hmm? Cadavers? Cadavers. Thank you. Oh, either. That's creative. That's Ashkenazi and Sephardi. Hasidish and Yekish. That's, now again, this is, you know, I remember asking, you know, as a kid, you know, what do they do in Israel about medical research? That's, well, the answer is that in Israel, modern Israel, people can give their bodies to medical research, and that's the way it goes. But here he's got, you know, you're trying to build up a Jewish state, right? So ideally, you know, you're not going to be relying on non-Jews, one might have thought. How are you going to conduct medical research? What are you going to do there? It's an interesting tshuva that he's got. Zeh mikvar ba'elai she'ilato b'inyan ha'metim ha'drushim b'shvil ha'nituach. So I've been asked this question about the bodies needed for medical research. Ledati, it seems to me, very important, saying the issue of nivul hamet, the issue of violating a dead body, is something which is specific to a Yisrael, specific to a Jew. Why? Shakadosh Baruch Hu tziva otanu al kedushat haguf. It's Shakadosh Baruch Hu has told us about the sanctity of the body. K'mo she'anu muzharim mimachalot asurot. And just as we're not allowed to eat forbidden foods, lo mitzad hateva shel haguf. That's not got nothing to do with the physical dimension of the human body. It's a function of the specific kedusha that a Jew has. Shekram Hashem Yibarach Goy Kadosh. Kadosh Baruch has called the Jewish people a holy nation. Va'goyim k'shem she'inam makpidim ala machalot rak ba'ofen tivi. Just as Gentiles, they're only particular about what they eat in terms of, you know, a natural tendency to be repulsed by certain types of foods, but there's no issue of kedusha involved. Kacha ein lahem shum tam lahakpid kol kacha laguf shelo yifnavel. So likewise, they don't have any reason to be so particular about the respect due to a dead body. Bishvil eza matara tivit kumo harufua. If there's some sort of need, like medical research. Al kein anachnu tzrichim liknot bekesef malei gviot meitim meumot haolam bishvil hamatara hamadait. Therefore, we should buy non-Jewish bodies of Gentiles to use for medical research. Ve'in lachush bazem mishum sinat hagoyim. We don't need to worry about non-Jews becoming anti-Semitic as a result of this. Yaisharim shabahem yavinu, because upright Gentiles will understand. Shesosof umazu, that at the end of the day, the Jewish people, shenivchara lahaviyet or hakodesh liyas Hashem emet ba'olam, who have been chosen to bring the light of God into the world, the sovelet alzet sarot merubot lein shiur, and therefore have suffered throughout history unreasonably. Hiru yag gamkein leizer privilegia shel kedusha. They'll understand that Jewish people have greater kedusha. Vamukul kalim shebahem. That's those who don't appreciate the spiritual superiority of Am Yisrael. Lo yachdelu lahalil alilot gamim nikach meitim Yisrael natcham. They'll be anti-Semitic anyhow, so it really doesn't make a difference. Ve'inyan ha-mechira va-mesira shel ha-gufim b'chayehem lo yuchal lahoel. A Jewish person can't donate his body to medical science even while he's alive, can't put in his will. Because the reason why you can't have nivul ha-meit is because you've got tzelem elokim. Shehu miyuchad liYisrael biyoter behirut mitzad hakdushat haTorah v'chelek gavah miyatir. And the Tzelem Elokim is a function of the kedushat haTorah, which is in a person. Now this is a fascinating tshuva from all sorts of perspectives. First of all, again, it's going back to this question of should a Jewish society be able to function without non-Jews? And he seems quite happy to, something we need non-Jews to provide our needs, as it were. Second of all, he's taking the notion of Tzelem Elokim, and we often talk about, till now, I've always said, even Gentiles are created, everybody is created Tzelem Elokim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created man, but Tzelem Elokim. What Rav Kook is doing, he's saying Tzelem Elokim is really something which belongs to Am Yisrael, not to the whole world. Tzelem Elokim, you're only but Tzelem Elokim if you've got that divine spark inside you, which is ignited by Torah. That's, otherwise, it's a much lower level of Tzelem Elokim. And the issue of Nivul Hamait is a function of Tzelem Elokim. And Goy doesn't have Tzelem Elokim. So it's a very... one wants to be very careful what one says, but a very Jew superior approach based not on an intrinsic racial superiority, of course, based on a spiritual superiority. And it's worth pointing out that, this is, I wouldn't regard a spiritual superiority as being racist in any sense, for the simple reason that we can say, anybody can convert to Judaism. That's anybody from any background, anybody from any racial or ethnic background can become Jewish and acquire the Tzelem Elokim. So it's open to everybody. Those who choose not to embrace it is a different matter. It's open there to everybody. But certainly, Rav Kook is making a big distinction here. Ben Kodesh Lachol, Ben Yisrael Lamin.
There's a big assumption being made that there won't be anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
That probably is the reason why we're probably more flexible on it nowadays.
I don't know if we are.
Yeah, well, I think his outlook, his general outlook, would probably be very different if he was writing these trivias 20, 30 years later.
You know, I don't. What's the date on this? There's no date on this. But you know, I think 33, but 33, 35 is what I told you. That's fine. He certainly saw the Chevron massacres.
Right, fine, but I'm saying that.
He saw pogroms in Russia.
Right.
I understand what you're saying. I think you're focusing on a side point in terms of he's saying that we don't need to worry about anti-Semitism for these reasons. Now, you can debate whether we do or don't. Okay. So that would be, that would be the question to which we'll never know the answer in terms of would the Holocaust experience have influenced him in any way, and we don't know.
But is there a reflection of that nuance with the post-Holocaust rabbi?
They're addressing different issues. We'll see as we, as we go through the tshuva. I think they're addressing slightly different issues. The final tshuva is fascinating. They're all fascinating, but this is particularly fascinating. It seems this was addressed to the Rav in Be'er Sheva. What date? Tuf Reish Pei Hei. So this would have been like 1925, something like that. So it seems Be'er Sheva must have been under Muslim control, Arab control. Al Data Sheh Sha'al B'inyan HaYishma'ilim. So the Arabs, the Muslims, are makpid. Now, it might not be that it was under Muslim control. Clearly what we're trying to do is, it's either that they were imposing restrictions on the shochtim, or it seems perhaps that the meat needed to be halal as well as being kosher. So it might have been so that, any animals which were halachically treif, that's but were acceptable to halal could be sold to the to the Arabs and eaten by them. Anyhow, the Yishma'ilim are makpidim. Shah shochet yomar ala achbar lifnei ashchita. So before you shecht, you have to say ala achbar. Now, of course, ala achbar just means God is great. Right? So it's not an expression of avodah zara. Kvar katru aposkim. They said this has been discussed by the poskim. Well-known question, apparently. If you can't get around it, and there'll be a financial loss to the Jews, so I assume this is probably the case that they want to be able to sell any treifas to or novellas to the Muslims. Exactly, because they won't buy the treifas or the hindquarters. If you can't get away without saying it, no, you can say it. You should say it before the bracha. Okay? You don't want to say Allah Shchita, Allah Akbar. Why? Because that would be a hefsek. Okay, it would be a hefsek between the bracha and the shchita. Or she tchila al off, or do the first shchita on a chicken, which apparently you didn't need to say Allah Akbar for, or the chickens weren't going to be used for halal or whatever it was. So say the bracha, shech the chicken, and then the bracha is chal on all the animals you're shechting after. You don't say bracha on every animal. In makpidim sheyezed achar bracha, if they insist that the ala achbar has to be after the bracha, immediately before the shechita. So then he's got the question of the Ishmaelim also say you need to be, the shochet needs to be facing panav lemizrach, needs to be facing the east, which is of course where the sun rises. That's though I'm not sure if that's because of the sun rising or that was an issue to do with Mecca. Okay, so he says in that case you really want to have, so long as the shochet is sort of He should position himself for all the shechita. Everything that he's doing, build the place, you know, in such a way that you're facing east. So it's not that you're particularly picking up this, taking this animal and then turning towards the east. That's and then if Gimel is dealing with issues to do with, they say that the shechita has to take place on a hilltop, and Sif Dala to do with the way they do the nikkur, the porging. But it just struck me as being a very sort of interesting tshuva that he's dealing with here. And I suppose this is, you know, probably Taf Resh Pei Hei. So this was 1925. I think he was already chief rabbi of Israel at the time. This, you know, is probably why the tshuva, you know, the Sheila was coming to him. In terms of, it's not, you know, nowadays we're certainly in this country, you know, a question about, you know, what goes on in the abattoirs, I don't think goes to Rabbi Mervis, right? More likely goes to the LBD, right? But the principle is, you know, he's answering it. The role of the Rav Rosh LaRabbanim, you know, was to deal with all these big rabbinic questions, standard rabbonus. It's like kind of an interesting question about, you know, is the Shochet allowed to call out Allah Akbar before he does the Shechita? And Rav Kook said that he is allowed to do so. I'd come with Rav Kook. Next week, we'll look, Be'ezrat Hashem, at Rav Herzog. It's interesting, the number of, you know, three of the Israeli chief rabbis had an important connection with England. There was Rav Kook, who spent time here. Rav Herzog was spent time in England and in Ireland. And then Rav Unterman, I'm not sure if we're covering Rav Unterman or not, but he was the Rav of Liverpool. Rav Herzog had a different set of concerns. Because Rav Herzog became chief rabbi, I'm not sure what year. I think prior to the Shoah, so maybe in 35, 36, but was chief rabbi during the early years of Midianite Israel as well. So he has a whole different, you know, there's a difference between, you know, being Jews under British mandate and where you're not formulating policy for a modern country, and being chief rabbi of Midianite Israel, which is trying to formulate a halachic policy for the Medina, and this is a state position. And also, of course, he lived through the Holocaust, and that influenced things as well. So I think the tshuvot we'll see next week of Rav Herzog will be much more illustrative of, you know, his role as chief rabbi of Israel rather than just a Rosh HaRabbanim, however important that role is. Adkan. That's...